Find other great podcasts like this one at podmoth.network.
If you're easily offended, this show may not be for you.
But if you're into that weird fun sh**, you've come to the right place.
You've been warned.
Are you there?
I'm Chris. I'm the believer.
I'm Cody. I'm the skeptic. Okay, stories. Let's get into it.
Hello, and welcome to BSP Believer Skeptic Podcast.
The podcast where two idiots debate weird phenomena.
I'm Chris. I'm the believer.
I'm Cody. I'm the skeptic.
And this is your first time listening to us. We are an LGBTQ paranormal comedy podcast and proud members of the Podmoth Network. And this is a full episode.
Yeah, so we have found a paranormal topic that
your sister suggested.
Yeah, my sister suggested it.
Even though she doesn't listen to the podcast because she's scared.
Okay. Yeah, she really is. She's like I'm going to get too scared. And I'm like, okay. But she came up with this idea. We're going to have some great stories. It's going to be really cool. And I'm trying to treat it delicately because my sister, well, she's very Catholic. And this is a Catholic episode. And I don't think she would have suggested it knowing that I was going to go in and just trash it, because she believes in this. And Chris has a story that is what made her mention this topic. And she believes in this story.
Yeah.
It's wild.
And I'm actually going to, because you know what that story is, I'm going to change it to my first story since it's the one that started it all.
Oh,
so
that
now,
great.
If you want to say what our topic is.
So Chris is going to go into detail, but we are going to be talking about Eucharistic miracles. And what that means is it's centered around, I didn't realize this, but non-Catholics don't know this. A lot of them don't. When the priest consecrates, you know, the bread and the wine to, you know, Christ's body and blood, Catholics, true Catholics, believe it is real. Like, they really think that it is turning into the body of Christ. Mm-hmm. Like, not symbolically,
it's literal.
But literal. Yeah. And so Eucharistic miracles are miraculous things that have happened around the body and blood of Christ that has been consecrated by a priest.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's crazy stories.
Yeah. And for my history, it doesn't quite talk about what Eucharistic miracles are. I have a different angle, but you can fill in the blanks if you want.
Oh, that sounds great. And I have, throughout my couple of stories, I do have little bits of education.
Okay, good.
For people who are non-Catholic to know.
I just came from a different angle. I think I told you about it, but I think you will enjoy this. So.
Oh, that's awesome.
But first, before that, we have to drink. Sorry, guys. I'm very exhausted. I just finished a 3-week run of my show. I went to the last show today, and it was very emotionally taxing. And, you know, here I am recording.
You're recording. Yeah, exactly. And I tore my left calf muscle.
So we're all kinds
of
messed
up. And so hobblecia. But this is going to be great.
Yeah. So do you want to go first or me?
Go for it. You're already digging through your bag.
Well, no, I was just going to get ready.
No, I did.
I went very easy and straightforward this time. I actually was going to get grape juice, because I grew up Methodist, and grape juice was the blood of Christ for us in church, you know, and dinner rolls.
Like Hawaiian rolls.
But instead, I decided, even though I know this is doesn't taste great because I've tasted it before, but I thought I would give it a second try. So I'm getting a red blend non-alcoholic by Free. So a Free red, F-R-E.
Have you had this exact one or is this a different
one? No, I've had the red before, but not the red blend.
Okay, so hopefully this one will be good.
Every red non-alcoholic wine, or every non-alcoholic wine I've had tastes gross.
All I heard was, every good boy does fine.
That's in music.
I know, my brain just went there. Well, while you pour that, I also went easy rational too, and I just got wine. However, there is a little addition to it because I wanted to get something that I would like because I'm Hobblecia, but the cover, it's barefoot, but the cover just has a footprint on it. Uh-huh. And if everyone remembers that story of the footprints in the sand, mm-hmm, with Jesus walking people, it kind of represents that.
I had posters of that all over my house. My mom had like two or three of them.
Oh, good. Yeah. So it's very reminiscent. How was your gross wine?
It just tastes like non-sweet grapes, basically. Oh, unsweetened grapes.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to get into this bad boy while you do some history.
All right. So I know what the Eucharist is, but not exactly the origin or when it all really started. So I would dive into some of that. At its most basic, a Eucharist is the Christian ceremony in which a wafer and wine are consumed as symbols of Jesus' body and blood in recognition of the Last Supper before Jesus' arrest and eventual persecution.
Yeah, and remember, Catholics don't see it as symbolic.
Yeah.
They see it as literal.
Yeah. What happens in the ceremony is bread and wine are taken, thanks and praise are offered to God over them, the bread is broken, and then the bread and wine is shared by all. The word Eucharist itself comes from the Greek word Eucharistia, which means thanksgiving. So although huge and symbolically important in the Christian religion, such practices were known to exist pre-Jesus in pagan practices.
Yeah, and I've never heard this. Interesting.
Yeah, I had not either, but as we have done research in past episodes, we've been finding that a lot of Christian practices are pagan, which isn't surprising, you know.
True.
But anyways, as the Eucharist is based upon the ritual conception of the God-man, such as in Greek religion, with gods such as Osiris and Dionysus when they were ritually consumed. At one time in our ancient past, human sacrifices would be identified with a specific deity, then sacrificed and eaten. Yeah, of course, such practices fell out of favor, and eventually animals were then utilized in the same manner. Sometime after that, the animal sacrifice also fell out of favor, so then communities began to lean towards bread offerings in which breads would be formed into a symbol of their chosen deity or in the shape of something representing the deity, such as the sun or the moon or something like that.
You know? Wow, so actual bread. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, that's pretty close.
Yeah, in BC, the Greeks invaded Israel and started a war with the intention of diminishing Hellenic influence, as we all know. One of the things they hoped to do with this was to update or completely change Jewish religion to better reflect what they said at that time period, you know.
Okay.
Those who know Judaism know that those fighting the war were driven into hiding by the Maccabees. This whole incident was influential on some of Jesus mythos as well. For example, the story of the god of vegetation, Attis, who was a Phrygian god but also worshipped by the Greeks, was one of these influences. In the myth, Attis is born from a virgin and as an adult also became a sacrificial victim and savior. According to legend, Attis was sent to wed the king's daughter and on his wedding day, quote unquote, went mad, their term, not mine, and cut off his genitals, resulting in his death. Yeah. Aegistus, a god with both male and female sex organs, was at fault for the incident and as a result repented and ensured that the body of Attis would neither rot or decay. Today, Attis is known for his self-mutilation, death, and resurrection, which represent the earth's vegetation, dying in winter only to return in spring.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. We can see the obvious parallels between him and Jesus. You know? According to Christianity, in the New Testament, Jesus, much like Attis, in his own way, sacrificed himself to the for the betterment of man. So you can see the connection to pagan religion and Christianity and as it relates to the Eucharist. You're looking at me like, what?
Wow.
Yeah. But try telling a Christian that, you know.
Oh my God. Yeah. I'll rip your genitals right off.
You see, the bread and wine are symbols of sacrifice, as were the animals and humans before them, to a god, gods, or godlike figures that many feared. In consuming these symbols, worshippers believed and believe today that if even symbolically, they would in some way be able to be a part of their deity. Here are some other thoughts on the Eucharist in Christianity. According to one Catholic writer, Adam and Eve took the forbidden fruit from the tree of life, the fruit representing the Eucharist after the fact, based on what is said in the book of Revelations, God will grant people to eat from the tree of life. So even though that was written later, they kind of relate it to the book at the beginning, you know?
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. Again, in Genesis, we have the king of Salem, a priest who offers bread and wine and blesses Abram. So even though the Last Supper had not occurred, similar practices were also already occurring long before that, you know? There are many other passages and stories in the Old Testament that show how the Eucharist was a thing before it was a Jesus thing. And coincidentally enough, this is news to me, Bethlehem, the place where Jesus was said to be born, literally means house of bread in Hebrew.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
Yeah, isn't that cool?
Oh, wow.
Jesus even foreshadowed the Eucharist before the Last Supper connection. In the miracle of loaves, he takes five loaves of bread, blesses it, breaks it, and gives it to his disciples. Eventually, at the Last Supper, Jesus gathers and prepares some of the previously mentioned symbols, and the consumption of bread and wine says, quote, "Do this in remembrance of me." Mm-hmm. As usual, there's so much more to the symbology and the religious practice, but that should give you some small insight into the institution of the Eucharist.
Yeah. All right.
What? You're...
Yeah, and I'm trying to think of, like, now we got to segue into these actual miracles around the Eucharist.
Yeah, no, and... I'm not shitting on everybody's belief, but that is some fascinating information I found that I never knew.
No, you know? I guess it's not surprising. And again, like
it is a theory, you know, but it's subjective, it's one person's opinion, you know, but still.
So the first thing I'm going to be talking about, and this would kind of be an introduction to the Eucharist, is a miracle that happened in Santarém, Portugal.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so Santarém is a town in Portugal 45 miles north of Lisbon and just a few miles south of Fatima.
Oh.
Yeah, which, as all good Catholics know, is a very religious site. Yes. Our Lady of Fatima was there. Chris, actually, you talked about it.
Our Lady of Fatima,
Fatima.
Fatima, yeah, whatever. Anyways, it was one of our Christmas ones, maybe?
I don't know. Sure. That's exactly a good memory, Chris.
I can't remember.
You forgot my story and stole it, but you remember that. Just kidding. This actually worked out well. Okay, so anyway, the miracle itself took place in the 13th century, and it was actually all centered around jealousy. So there was an unhappy woman who lived there in the mid-1200s. Mm-hmm. Now, why was she so unhappy? Well, she was convinced that her husband was being unfaithful. Mm-hmm. So she tried all the possible means to bring him back, you know, to her, to faithfulness, but nothing worked. So finally, on February 16th, 1266, as an act of desperation, she turned to sorcery.
How old were you then?
Time to consecrate you. That made no sense. I don't know what that means. But she turned to sorcery, visiting the local sorceress of the town. The sorceress promised her that her husband would again love her like before. Mm-hmm. But in return, what she wanted was a consecrated host. Which I think is so interesting. And let me just point out.
Ooh,
yeah.
Why?
And so it said that she was using it to make a love potion.
Okay.
I don't quite understand that. But I want to explain something to people real quick. Because the woman balked. And I want people to know how sacred the host is to Catholics. It is so sacred. And handing one over to like a pagan.
Just or to anybody.
To anybody would be the ultimate in sacrilege. The ultimate.
And that being said, that is definitely a Catholic viewpoint. Growing up Methodist, they allowed anybody that felt they wanted to or were called to do so. You know,
and in Catholic churches, you only have to. Catholics who are baptized and have made their first communion can partake. And I want to share a little story that so you know how serious it is.
Yeah.
So because Catholics actually believe that it is the body and blood of Christ, there have been moments where you know, say one of the ministers at the church, you know, is up there with the goblet. And, you know, gives the wine to someone and some will spill out. Mm-hmm. Well, it is like an entire process. Immediately, they have to drop the cloth that they use to wipe it onto the spot and leave it so no one else can touch it on the ground or step on it. So it can't be desecrated in any way. They leave it. They have to rush back and set, you know, the goblet down. And then there's like an entire cleaning process around it.
Yeah.
So it is a big deal. It's such sacrilege. So... you can imagine then that this woman was pretty scared by this, you know, like she knew the sacrilege, but she finally agreed. That's how desperate she was. Mm-hmm. So after receiving communion in her parish church of St. Stephen, she did not consume the host, but left the church immediately, took it out of her mouth and placed it in her headscarf.
Oh, wow. Talk about sacrilege.
And so that's another thing, too, that a lot of non-Catholics don't know is that many, many Catholics choose to take communion directly on their tongue.
And you can not do it in to your touch hand. Them. Yeah.
Yes, because they don't want to touch it. So the priest, they will stick out their tongue and the priest will put it directly on their tongue. So she kept it there, took it out, put it in the scarf, right?
That's crazy.
On her way home, the host started to bleed in her scarf. The woman didn't realize this was happening until people passing by were like, "Girl, you're hurt." And at first, she thought that she had severely cut her hand and didn't realize it. But then she realized that it was the host bleeding, and she started to panic. Mm-hmm. So instead of going to the sorceress's house, she went home and placed the host covered in the scarf at the bottom of a wooden chest in her room. She remained there just absolutely consumed with fear. When her husband arrived later that evening, they went to sleep. Well, he went to sleep because she was just consumed by guilt.
Yeah.
And she was just, you know, consumed with this thought that the host was still bleeding in this chest because of her. And that's when another huge miracle occurred.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, in the darkness of the room, brilliant rays of light began emanating from the chest. It was so bright, it awoke the husband. They turned to the chest, and they watched something truly amazing happen. They saw a vision of angels adoring the holy host that was bleeding.
Interesting.
The woman couldn't hold it back, and she confessed everything to her husband. In return, he came clean to her. Mm. So both of them repented and spent the rest of the night kneeling in adoration before the miraculous host.
Yeah.
The next morning, they informed the priest, and he went to the house and heard this story. So they returned to the Church of St. Stephen in a very, very solemn procession,
mm-hmm.
and he placed the host that was still bleeding in a reliquary made of beeswax. Hmm. It remained there until a second miracle occurred, or third, in 1340.
Yeah.
In 1340, a priest opened the tabernacle door and realized that the beeswax reliquary had disintegrated into tiny pieces. But in its place, there was a new reliquary made of glass that still contained the blood of the host, and it contains it to this day. It's now preserved in an 18th century Eucharistic throne above the main altar, and the Church of St. Stephen is now known as the Shrine of the Holy Miracle. So to this day, you can actually see it in that glass reliquary, and miracles continue. Throughout the centuries, on various occasions, the host has given new emissions of blood, and in some cases, various images of our Lord are seen in that Eucharist. Among the witnesses of this prodigy is St. Francis Xavier, who I recommend anyone to look up, who was an apostle of the Indies who visited the shrine before he would go on missions. And that is just a little bit about the bleeding host in in Portugal. And yes, so I think that gives people an idea of what a Eucharistic miracle is.
Yeah. Well, so for my first story, I thought I would go old school with the Eucharistic miracle. You could say kind of started it all.
Yes.
This story was originally Cody's, but I did my research first. I had forgotten, and I did my research first, and I was like, I did this story. He's like, you mean the one I was going to do? Whoops.
And then he sent me a little dog meme that was like, I'm sorry. I have such a bad memory for that stuff that I was like, it could have been me.
Yeah.
But this is the story my sister mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
She told me almost no detail, just a few sentences.
Oh, so you don't even know this?
No. I know a little bit, but I was like, stop. I was like, okay, I'm going to do this.
Yeah,
so you can fill it in.
So I'm talking about the miracle of L'Anciano, which is the first and for many the greatest Eucharistic miracle to date. In a small town in central Italy called L'Anciano, in the 700s, there was a monastery that was established by the monks of St. Basil. The monastery was built in honor of St. Longinus, who was thought to be the centurion at the crucifixion that claimed Jesus, quote, truly this was the Son of God, unquote.
Oh, yeah.
Before piercing Jesus' side with his lance. But back to the monastery. Here, a monk described as, quote, versed in the sciences of the world but ignorant in that of God, was offering a mass. This monk was having many questions and doubts about transubstantiation.
I always have a hard time. And that is the transformation of the body, of the bread to the body.
Oh, I was just going to say.
Were you really?
Yeah.
Oh, go continue.
As he said, transubstantiation is the official term for the miraculous transformation of bread and wine into the literal body and blood of Christ. So this sciency monk was doubting this could possibly occur, wondering if wine and bread truly transformed at consecration or if Jesus was even present in the Eucharist.
Oh, true. And can I point out, if people are confused, that whenever Catholics take it, mm-hmm. it doesn't taste any different. Like, it mm-hmm. tastes like bread. It tastes like wine.
Yeah.
You know, there's never any, like, that's all it ever is.
Yeah.
But it's part of the miracle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, during the Mass, when the monk came down to the portion where he states, this is my body, this is my blood, drink this in remembrance of me, the monk saw the bread turn into literal flesh and the wine change into literal blood.
Oh, could you imagine?
Yeah, that would be creepy. Like, oh. That would be weird. It was said that the blood coagulated into 5 large drops that were irregular and differed in shape and size. As anybody would be, The monk was absolutely astounded. This was the sign he was looking for, and with that, weeping for joy, he called forth the congregation to witness the miracle themselves.
Well, you know, we all ask for signs.
Yeah.
That's a doozy. Was he holding the bread? Like, did he just flop and turn into like a...
That I don't... It didn't say.
Oh, that would be so weird. Okay. Yeah.
As he called them forth, he proclaimed, quote, "O fortunate witnesses to who the blessed God, to confound my unbelief, has wished and revealed himself visible to our eyes. Come, brethren, and marvel at our God so close to us. Behold the flesh and blood of our most beloved Christ."
Wow.
And of course, as the congregation left Mass that day, they spread the good news throughout the town. Following the incident, the archbishop, being a little leery, ordered an investigation in which witness testimony would be recorded. According to the investigation, the flesh and blood both appeared to be human.
Oh, shit.
After the investigation ended, the flesh and the drops of blood were placed in a very special ivory reliquary. Eventually, the church would certify the incident a miracle. That being said, considering this occurred sometime during the 700s, the original documentation of the event was lost sometime in the 1500s.
Okay.
Since the event occurred, the relics have been passed from hand to hand, being that different people have gained or forced their custody on both the church and relics. The St. Basil Monastery had them on hand until 1176. Then they landed in the hands of the Benedictine monks who held on to them until 1252, when the Franciscans got a hold of them. The original church that they were at, of course, began to decay, so a new church was built by the Franciscans, who to this day care and house these fascinating relics.
Wow.
Since the initial investigation, the church has given permission for the relics to be studied. The most conclusive being that the one that occurred in 1970 through 71, when the Pope gave permission for a scientific study, which was also corroborated 10 years later. According to these studies, yellowish-brown flesh has the structure of the type of flesh normally surrounding the heart.
Wow.
The flesh did not appear to be preserved in any way. And as for the blood, it was said to be human and type AB, containing elements normally found in human blood.
So like Jesus was type AB? Wouldn't that be weirdly symbolic if that's the universal donor?
Yeah, I don't
know. Oh, I need to look that up, because that means Jesus can give to anybody. Oh my gosh. Okay, I'm going to look that up.
And then one professor noted that the blood, being as old as it was, the blood should have deteriorated by that time, which it still has not.
You know? Oh, yeah, or the flesh, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In addition to this, it was concluded that only a skilled pathologist could have retrieved such a sample, since it, you know, was around the heart, which obviously was not available in the 700s, you know. But since 1713, the relics were transferred from the ivory reliquary to one made of silver and crystal that was made in Naples. And as of 2012, the miraculous relics were kept in the Church of San Francesco in the town of Lanciano. And that is the story of the OG Eucharistic miracle known as the Miracle of Lanciano.
The OG. That's the original gangsta miracle.
Yep.
Wait, it was type AB?
AB.
So that is the universal receiver blood. So that almost symbolically says Jesus has his arms open and is welcoming everybody. That's, of course, you can rationalize anything,
that's,
but still.
Interesting.
I wonder if that type, how deliberate that would be, whoever, wow, that's so wild.
Yeah.
I mean, so I don't even know what to say to that.
Yeah. The corroboration of those studies, especially, you know.
That's the thing about my second story, too, is all the studies that went into it that make it truly interesting.
Well, truly, like, at least makes it seem more probable or possible. You know?
Like,
because these are two scientists that study this 10 years apart.
Yep. And if that monk was just trying to fool the system, where did he get the heart flesh? From a person, like...
Yeah, from a human.
Yeah, they're going to discover...
Like, did he murder somebody?
It's like Jack the Ripper's origins.
Yeah.
Hey, Twisted listeners, I'm Cindy.
And I'm Diva.
And we are Twisted Listers, a weekly podcast about murder.
And lists.
Each week, we choose a new topic and we cover 10 cases all under that common theme.
We've done incredible fun topics like family annihilators.
Cannibals.
Killer grandmas.
And we've also done survivor stories for those of you that like a more uplifting tale. So if this sounds like your kind of party, join us every Monday wherever you like to listen to podcasts. So yeah, we hope you tune in and we hope that you stay
off
our lists. Bye.
All right. So miracle number two for me is the miracle in Siena, Italy. So the Eucharistic miracle of Siena has its roots in the 13th century when special services and festivals were introduced to, in honor of the Feast of the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know, a lot of people don't know what that is, but Mary supposedly did not die. She was assumed into heaven. So when it was her time to go, and this was years after Jesus died, mm-hmm. she was basically just like risen on a cloud up into heaven.
Okay.
And that's called the Assumption of Mary. Mm. Now, on August 14th of 1730, during devotions for the vigil of the feast, while most of the Sienese population and the clergy of the city were attending these services, mm-hmm. thieves took advantage and they entered the deserted church of St. Francis. Mm. Taking advantage of the friar's absence, they made for the chapel where the Blessed Sacrament was kept,
yeah.
picked the lock to the tabernacle, and carried away the golden ciborium containing the consecrated hosts. Now, I don't know if Chris knows this, but to anyone else, also the ciborium, that's that the actual goblet, if you will, that holds the host.
And oh, okay.
Many of them are very expensive, even today, because, you know, you want something beautiful.
Well, I'm sure they come from the Vatican, so that's tons of money and made from, like, gold from Italy.
Yes, yeah. And you know, there are magazines and stuff where you can buy them, and, you know, they can be thousands and thousands of dollars. They can mm-hmm. have jewels in them, so they could be definitely valuable.
Yeah.
Now, the theft went undiscovered until the next morning when the priest opened the tabernacle at the communion
yeah.
and saw that it was missing. So later, a parishioner found the lid of the ciborium lying in the street, and that was where suspicion of sacrilege was confirmed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the anguish of the parishioners forced the cancellation of all the festivities, and they basically kind of went on a search for the consecrated hosts. And again, just remember, if that sounds weird, how important, you know, and how sacred the hosts are when they've been consecrated.
Yeah.
So imagine, like, instead of for missing kids, a whole line of people holding hands, like walking through the streets, like looking for the hosts. Well, 2 days later, they saw something protruding from the offering box in the church.
Oh.
Realizing it was a host, the person who saw it informed the other priests, who in turn notified the archbishop and the friar there. When it was opened, they found all the missing hosts inside, entangled in cobwebs and dirt. After being cleaned as much as possible, the hosts were placed in a new ciborium and taken back to the church for prayers of reparation and veneration.
Yeah.
Because see, since the hosts were dirty, the priests were like, we can't consume this.
Yeah, you know.
So we're just going to let them deteriorate, but do these prayers to cleanse, you know, like the sacredness of it. But over the next few decades, the hosts did not deteriorate. In fact, they even took on a very pleasant, beautiful smell.
Flowery
smell, right? And it actually said, it never said what the smell was. It said it was pleasant.
Yeah, because so, anytime we read like relics or incorruptibles, there's always this flowery scent.
And this one just said pleasant. And I think of like, maybe it's like Harry Potter and that love potion where you smell what it smells good to you.
Yeah.
So for me, it's like chocolate chip cookies.
Thai food.
It's like, oh my God. I'm like, this host is like pad Thai. It's holy. But with the passage of time, people believe that they were witnessing a continuing miracle. So 50 years later, an official investigation was conducted into the authenticity of the miracle. Dear Lord, I cannot talk today.
Uh-huh.
But on April 14th, 1780, one of the minister general of the Franciscan order tasted one.
Oh.
And found it fresh and incorrupt. I'm just imagining.
I just say ew, because like these things have been, we found them dirty and cobwebby. And then B, they've been sitting around for 50 plus years.
I wonder what, ew. Like, either what preparation they had to do or what made him decide. Like, if he was like, like fear factor and just did it, or if he had reason to believe. I don't know. I'm just imagining
he was
first
called
taste.
By the spirit.
Yeah, he was called, like, that first taste must have been like, oh, is this scary?
Yeah.
Well, as a test to further confirm the authenticity of the miracle, the archbishop, during a 1789 examination, ordered several unconsecrated hosts to be placed there and kept under lock in the office.
To see if they would deteriorate in comparison.
Yep. And 10 years later, they were examined and found to be withered. And then in 1850, 61 years later, the unconsecrated hosts were completely ruined, while the consecrated hosts still smelled like pad Thai.
That's crazy.
Yep. In 1914, then, the professor of chemistry at the University of Siena as well as a holder of lots of other distinguished positions in the field of chemistry, examined the hosts. Afterward, he wrote, "The holy particles of unleavened bread represent an example of perfect preservation, a singular phenomenon that inverts the natural law of the conservation of organic material. It is a fact that it is unique in the annals of science."
Annals.
Did I say the right word?
You said anals. Anals. Annals.
In the anal cavity of science. And they remain completely fresh and preserved to this day. They're actually on display publicly. Uh-huh. And on the 17th of each month, which commemorates the day they were found after the original theft, they are like kind of paraded. And then on the feast of Corpus Christi, the sacred hosts are placed in a processional monstrance and triumphantly carried in a procession through the streets of the town.
Wow.
And that is the story of Siena.
I've never heard any of these, probably because I'm not Catholic.
But it's not just you. Like, I've never heard of any of this.
Yeah.
Like, let me just say.
I hope you've never heard of this next one because sure it's so cool.
I actually had to type the name of yours to find anything just to make sure I wasn't copying it.
Oh, yeah.
So I was like, I don't know what this is. I will say I'm not surprised at any of this. Mm-hmm. But I will say that I did not know any of these stories in detail.
Wow. Well, usually when talking about Eucharistic miracles, they are associated with saints or other highly regarded holy individuals from hundreds, thousands of years ago. Well, for my second story...
Hundreds of thousands of years ago. in the day of the dinosaur, we had hosts, Eucharistic miracles.
Well, for my second story, I am talking about a person who, although Roman Catholic, is neither a saint or a holy person, and also... lived within my lifetime, at least. So this is...
So in the 1800s? Sorry, 1600s.
Bitch, please. I am talking about Martha Robin. Martha was considered a mystic and stigmatist. Listen to our Stigmata episode for more information on that.
So she had stigmata?
Yeah, yeah.
But she wasn't a saint or anything, just a random Catholic with stigmata.
Yeah.
Okay.
And she also founded an association of charity homes within her lifetime. On March 13th, 1902, Martha was born, which would make her 122 years ago, just a few days ago, or 202 years old a few days ago.
That's fast math.
In southeastern France, to a peasant farming family. She was the youngest of six children and attended a local primary school until she was 13, when she did not continue her education, but instead took it upon herself to help out the family on the farm.
Okay.
At a young age, Martha was drawn to prayer, stating, quote, "I always really loved God when I was a little girl. I have always prayed throughout my life." Of course, she said that in French.
Je suis perpétuée. Being Joey from Friends. Blably, blably, blably.
Oh, gosh, no. It was a little unusual that she would become so immersed in prayer, as her family were non-practicing Catholics. You know, a year after her birth, Robin and her sister both got typhoid fever, which unfortunately caused her sister's death. Martha herself got very sick and was close to death, but miraculously recovered. Although she recovered, it was said that she did not have very good health thereafter throughout her childhood. Fast forward 15 years to 1918. Martha again got very sick, falling into a coma for 4 days.
Oh my God.
Doctors believe she had a brain tumor, but when she came out of her coma, her health improved. Although a few weeks later, her illness again would only get worse, leaving her partially paralyzed as well as unable to see for many months thereafter. After over two very arduous years in 1921, she went into remission. Despite the good news, her health would continue to go up and down, eventually leaving her fully paralyzed in her lower body.
Oh, God.
By 1928.
This poor woman.
Yeah. She would remain paralyzed as such for the rest of her life, and due to that, would also remain in the care of her family and friends for that time. To add to her paralysis, she was also extremely sensitive to light, which resulted in her becoming reclusive and living out her remaining days in a dark bedroom.
She's like Mrs. Havisham or something.
Despite or because of the many ailments that plagued her, Martha's faith became stronger.
Stronger?
Yeah.
Wow, good for her. I would be like, Lord, why are you doing this to me?
Yeah.
But she was only paralyzed from the waist down.
Yeah.
Oh, because I was like, if it was the neck down and she had stigmata... Like, what's she going to do if it starts bleeding or anything? Yeah. Just like, okay.
Yeah.
Help.
Her faith became so strong that she wrote an act of abandon and love to the will of God. Wanting to give her life to God and Christ, she enacted the practice of the Eucharist from then on. So along with her devotion came some mystical phenomenon that was witnessed by men, by many, which are recorded in the Diocesan Inquiry. Is that what it's
called? Uh-huh. The right. Diocesan?
Yeah, Diocesan Inquiry. Her sister Ella stated that Marta had a personal vision of the Virgin Mary in 1922. She also stated that 6 years later, Christ appeared to Marta. Marta's visions were reported to the local priest, and from that time on, he decided to give her she decided to give her life completely to God, centering her spirituality around the Passion of the Christ and the Eucharist. During that same year, two priests visited Marta, and after long talks with her, it was decided she would enter the Franciscan Third Order. This meant, in a nutshell, that she was a lay person of the religious order that can wear habits and participate in other religious rites. Yeah. As a result of her devotion, 2 years later, in 1930, Marta made the decision to eat no food other than the Eucharist. That same year, Marta's first stigmata would appear.
Wow.
In addition, every Friday, she would relive the Passion of the Christ.
Oh, God, that would be awful.
Yeah, both of these extreme practices were witnessed by a number of people and would last until her death in 1981 at the age of 78.
And with all those health problems, she lived to 78?
Yep.
Okay, and by reliving the Passion of the Christ...
Yeah. You want to explain that?
Well, was she Christ in this?
I don't know. That's all it said in what I read. Yeah.
Because all I can imagine, if I'm thinking, and I really don't know, but I'm guessing mm-hmm. that if she relived it, that she probably did it through the eyes of Christ. So she felt the crown of thorns. She felt the nails. Like she felt every all of week. That every week. Mm-hmm. Oh, man. I wonder, like, how do you prepare for something like that?
Yeah.
Like, ooh.
Yeah. So as until the day she died, and then on the morning of her death, it was said Marta had a coughing fit that would not get better. Eventually, she would die from what was assumed to be exhaustion. Her funeral...
After reliving
yeah,
hundreds and hundreds of Passions of Christ,
yeah.
That would be exhausting.
Her funeral was attended by four bishops and 200 priests. As for the recorded diocesan inquiries, the Catholic Church is currently examining their authenticity for Marta's potential beatification.
I was about to say, how is she not a saint with all this?
This has been in process since 1986.
Wow.
In 2014, Pope Francis recognized the heroic virtues of Marta, resulting in venerable declaration and recognition of a miracle which could possibly be one step closer to complete beatification.
Wow.
And that is the miraculous and wow story of Marta Robin.
So if and this is something that I do know, that there are a limited number of saints and people in history
mm-hmm.
who supposedly lived on nothing but the body of Christ. Yeah, and so that means
she did
that
for 50 years.
If just think about this, people, that basically every day she would get one host
mm-hmm.
and a sip of wine.
Yep.
And and I've read that some of these people who do that live perfectly healthy lives, even though that's clearly malnutrition,
yeah.
You know, and so that's something that she survived on. Yep. So it's really amazing. And my mom had talked about just that condition.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know about this person and all the other stuff, but yeah. That's something that I was aware of.
Yeah, her story really blew my mind.
Like, it's crazy. Mm-hmm. She's alive in the age of media. Is there a video of her reliving?
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Like, yeah. I would think there should be somewhere.
Early 80s. She died in 81.
Yeah, so
maybe.
In the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, no one was like, let's record her doing the Passion of the Christ.
No idea.
And then Mel Gibson can use that for inspiration.
I have no idea. I'd have to look that up.
Huh. Well, that is interesting. Well, yeah, I have a feeling. That's one of those things where, saint or not, if a person undergoes that much physical trauma, but they're still faithful and good people, like, look up to that, you know? Because I think I would be a drunk mess.
Yeah.
You know? Like, my calf alone is making me just want to give up my will to live and die.
Maybe you need to go to church.
Maybe. My sister's been trying to get me to go.
Yeah.
So, anyway. Unbeliever skeptic. Okay. Yes. So, true to my kind of inner promise to Wendy, I did not do a super huge debunk of this.
Yeah.
But I did. I wanted to present something just as food for thought. Hey, pun. Chris, I mean, you're reading something.
No, I was just making sure that something I had written was correct. But anyways. Yeah.
That's anyway, so about the host in Siena. Acid and starch tests performed on one of the fragments
mm-hmm.
indicated a normal starch content. Mm-hmm. So the conclusions reached from microscopic tests did indicate that the host had been made of roughly sifted wheat flour, which was found to be well preserved.
Okay.
Now, one commission came together and agreed that unleavened bread, and so just everyone knows, the host, like the bread, is always unleavened. It, mm-hmm. it never rises. There's no yeast in it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's like an important thing. But they said that unleavened bread, if prepared under sterile conditions or the right conditions and kept in like a correct container, mm-hmm. could be preserved for an extremely long time.
Yeah.
And so that's something to keep in mind. And you might say, well, the unconsecrated host didn't, but you're not sure how that batch was made compared to the batch that, you know, actually is still preserved today.
Yeah.
And so that is something for maybe skeptics to think about. But either way, I think you have to admit that there's some really interesting stuff.
Unprovable stuff.
Yeah. Like it's really wild. I love that this happened because I actually had mentioned a couple times that I wanted to do stories of people who lived on the body of Christ. Mm-hmm. But I love that it got mixed into something like this, yeah. which was crazy. All right. On yeah. to believer.
So do I believe in miracles? In a sense, I do. What I mean is that I believe events can occur that we have no explanation for, which would some could potentially label miraculous.
That's, I thought you would have said, I believe in miracles.
Well, I know.
I believe in miracles, baby.
The thing is, I cannot really explain how some people have survived on the Eucharist and that alone, you know, mm-hmm. and I don't think that even science can explain it, because anyone who has gone to communion on an empty stomach can tell you that piece of bread and thimble of wine yeah. can only suffice for so long, you know.
There you go.
But I digress. So I look at miracles as a whole. According to one person's opinion in my research, there are three potential reasons miracles occur. First is just that they simply actually do happen.
Okay.
According to scientific thought and some philosophers, miracles cannot be performed without defying the laws of science. But if the laws of nature were not violated, how would you explain something as, quote, simple as breathing or walking? You know, you could say that's miraculous in itself.
And you could have said that hundreds of years ago mm-hmm. when there was no explanation for it.
Exactly. Yeah. Secondly, the second reason is that believing in miracles is a projection of wishful thinking. Meaning people believe in miracles because they think they take place because people want to remain hopeful even in times of tragedy.
Absolutely.
And I get that.
Yeah.
And the third reason people believe in miracles, belief in miracles has cognitive and developmental origins in that a cognitive mechanism can detect violation of scientific law, which appears as early as infancy. Your face is like, what?
What the fuck was that? I didn't understand a word of that. Did you?
Yeah. Meaning, and again, cognitive mechanism, it can, like, your brain can tell when it's, like, doing something weird, like going against the laws of nature, is basically what they're saying in a nutshell. It's hard to really explain fully. Yeah. And that you know that as a baby, that you have that cognition, you know?
Interesting.
Anyways, psychologists also argue that believing in miracles has survived a long time because they have minimal counterintuitiveness in common. Meaning, well-known miracles often deviate slightly from intuitive expectations, but do not involve overly counterintuitive elements. In other words, much like mythologies, miracles span generations because they offer an idea that is challenging enough to attract attention. They also avoid overtaxing people's conceptual systems. All that being said, now, if miracles do happen, is a matter of faith and belief, but that's for you to decide. Cody didn't understand all my intellectual speak.
I'm going to have to go look some of that shit up.
Yeah. I can send, you can follow the links on our website, you know, because I have them all there.
That's true. That's true. Because my eyes crossed during that.
I know what I was saying.
Some of that would be a good skeptic.
I guess.
Know? But interesting. We've all had those things happen to us, yeah. you know.
All right, now we get on to Creep of the Week.
Creep of the Week! Oh my God, that was a miracle.
Since we're talking about Jesus, get this. A historian, David Adkins, is claiming that the Shroud of Turin is a tablecloth from England and that the image of the shroud is from a statue.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. He claims that the cloth was actually wrapped around a statue that the Knights Templar had commissioned back in the day. According to him, the alabaster and gypsum the statue is made from reacted to the dampness of the cloth, leaving an imprint. Of the statue, he says it was either hidden or destroyed. Then the knights or whoever, you know, found the cloth or had the cloth done. You know, they outlined the figure of the cloth with their own blood in order to pass it off as the infamous shroud.
Wow.
A theory indeed, but a, you know, strange one at that. That being said, it's as good a theory as any because we really don't know for sure. You know, nobody does except for people that were there.
That's true.
So, yeah.
I didn't understand any of that either.
What? Shut up. What?
Just kidding. No, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Okay, so with the, oh God, miracle or not, my sister's old boss claimed that she pooped once every 2 weeks.
Ew.
Yeah, that's what she promised. Every other week she would poop one time.
That's not a miracle. That's, she needs more fiber in her fucking diet.
It would be like 3 feet long. Ew. By the time it came out.
Ew. She can't even shut the toilet lid.
It just curl touches her.
Ew. Anyways, ew, nasty. Well, thank you everybody for listening to all of that. This was a weird topic, but
I think it was so great,
absolutely fascinating. This yep. this kind of stuff always fascinates me. So,
yeah.
With that, again, thank you for listening to us. You can find us on all the platforms where you find podcasts. You can find us on social media by following at BSPodPHX. If you have any stories of your own, religious, paranormal, supernatural, etc., send them to bspodphx@gmail.com.
Perfect. And my books, The Gay Teen's Guide to Defeating a Siren, as always, are available on Amazon. And I'm exhausted after that episode.
Yeah.
That was a ride. I want to hear people's reactions to this, especially listeners who aren't Catholic, who don't know a lot of this, just to see, like, was this insane? Or
yeah.
or what?
Yeah.
But anyway, everyone, we hope you have a lovely week. Send us your creeps of the weeks and all the good stuff. And
with that,
bye.
See you again next time.